Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Tonight's guest is Mark Boccuzzi, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-815-9756, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
Hello, Fran, and I think it's only fitting that we have Mark on with us to the show, it being that Halloween is coming up on Sunday, and one of his many research interests is so-called ghost hunting, and we'll be talking with him a little bit after the first break. And, you know, finally we got to see that long-awaited movie that finally came out, Hereafter.
But you know what I'm Hereafter.
Yeah. And I know the both of us went to see it. And I know you started a little forum on Facebook.
On our Forever Family Foundation Facebook page, we set up a discussion page, and there's been quite a few postings already. Anybody who wants to go there and post their opinion or even ask their question, there are people on the discussion who have seen it and people who have not.
Right.
So, and I know also this morning another one popped up on our LinkedIn. So there's actually two discussions out there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was trying to gauge, you know, monitor some of the responses, and some people have also written in with their, you know, reviews, and I'm currently, you know, writing an article for the next newsletter about it. But most of taking a poll, I would say, I don't know what you found, but most of the comments were on the positive side than the negative.
Well, it's positive all in the same vein. It's like, oh, thank heavens people are finally recognizing it as a real thing and not something to be freaky, scary Hollywood stuff. But I know when we were leaving the theater, there was a lot of chit-chat you could overhear, and there was a lot of mixed commentary. I think people are just so accustomed to sitting in a movie theater and being entertained that they were expecting some sort of entertainment out of it.
Right, rather than thought-provoking stuff. Well, certainly when it comes to the afterlife, and I don't know that it's been portrayed like this before. I think it was very well balanced. I think for those of you who haven't seen it, the film melds three different characters together. One had a near-death experience, another one was a medium, and the third
was a young boy who was a twin.
Right,
who lost his brother.
Right, and you know, there are certain things, like one objection I had was in the near-death experience, from all the things that I've read, most people who have had NDEs report very clear and visions and depictions and of the afterlife and seeing deceased loved ones, you know, clearly and so forth. And I know that in the film, when the character is going through the NDE, it was portrayed as being a, you know, wispy, cloudy, kind of nebulous.
Right, and I think that's where a lot of people lost it, because the big question in the discussion group was, so how can this wispy, faint-looking thing that looks like, you know, Close Encounters of a Third Kind rather than a near-death experience move this woman to such, you know, earth-shattering change of life that she, you know, she leaves her job and writes a different book. And on one hand, you're questioning what was Hollywood thinking, but on the other hand, you're saying there is no way. There really is no way, not in a movie, not in words, not in anything that we know, to convey the feeling that people who have had near-death experiences try to explain they've had.
Right, and that's why you constantly hear the experiences being ineffable, so, you know, it can't be put into words. However, I think that it could have done, could have come a little bit, you know, closer. Like you say, the character does change her life based upon her experience, but, you know, the experience was so vague, you wonder why, you know? So that didn't seem to mesh.
Right, but that missed.
What I did, you know, I like the fact that mediumship was portrayed in a fair light, and a matter of fact, it showed, you know, the main character was a very good, you know, medium, and they also showed some...
They showed a lot of fakes, and I think that that's good, because proportionately out there, there are a lot of fakes,
right.
And there are a lot of people who believe that they are developed enough to sit and read other people, and they're not. And we know this just from our own medium certification program, how important it is for somebody who is so on the edge of having lost someone, and that's a do-or-die situation. If you sit before a medium that's not going to give you evidence, they're pushing you off that cliff that you so much want to jump off.
I saw that, you know, some of the comments that I was reading from listeners and from members were that they were disappointed that they thought that the film portrayed the medium as being, you know, tortured, leading a tortured existence, which because of his abilities, and I guess that was the way it was portrayed. But it's true that there are a lot of mediums that don't know how to control their ability.
They don't know that they can control their ability.
Right, and because of that, they do have difficult lives, you know. And
right, but I think his difficult life was he had a brother, and the brother had a normal life. And, you know, it's, well, why can't I have this normal life? So that's what he was, in the movie, that's what he's comparing himself to. He's not really saying, oh, this whole thing is so torturous. You know, he just was longing for a normal life.
Yeah.
And a real relationship.
Well, it also struck me as being, you know, dead on, so to speak. It showed you people that normally didn't think about an afterlife or really didn't care about an afterlife or didn't question it, all of a sudden when faced with a trauma of some sort, then they turn for answers, which was the same way as was depicted in the film, and that's true. But what's the first step that the people would use to search for answers? Google. You know, and it struck me in years past, people questioning an afterlife, they'd probably go to their clergyman, you know.
We all know better than that.
Place of worship, you know. And Google's replaced the clergy in a search for answers in today's, you know, world. You know,
because Google's got all the answers.
Yeah. And it takes them, you know, you in a million different directions. And, you know, that's
and not only thing. That. When you go to one person, any kind of person, as a source for your answers, you're only going to get that person's opinion
right. Or
that person's exposure. When you go to Google, you get a whole list to pick from.
Right. Well, I encourage anybody who hasn't seen the film to see it and let us know your thoughts. And you can always contact us with your comments on radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org. So I think we'll go to our break now, and when we come back, we'll have our esteemed guest, Mark Bacuzzi, talking about all sorts of what we consider to be paranormal things. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Did you know that there is an abundance of scientific evidence from well-credentialed scientists suggesting an afterlife? You now have an opportunity to learn about this evidence firsthand at Forever Family Foundation's conference in Fort Myers, Florida, November 13th and 14th. If you have suffered the loss of a loved one, or are simply curious about what happens after we die, don't miss this chance to see scientists and certified mediums share their knowledge and insights in lectures, workshops, and demonstrations, including small group medium readings. call 631-425-7707 or visit foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com. I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Mark Boccuzzi. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. Bob?
And Mark is the co-founder and the director of operations of the Wimbridge Institute. He's spent probably more than a decade now investigating and researching survival of consciousness and psi phenomena. Both in the lab and in the field. So he's looking at it from both perspectives. He has an extensive background before Wimbridge. I know he was a project manager at the Exploratorium, the Museum of Science, Art, and Human Perception, where he worked on a wide range of research and exhibit development projects funded by the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health. And in addition to survival research, his interests include applied intuition, psychokinesis, electronic voice phenomena, and distant mental interactions on living systems. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Fran. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Hey.
You know, I think it's established already from our talk that, you know, you've pretty much had a lifelong, you know, fascination with parapsychology and things that go bump in the night. And was there anything in your childhood that jumpstart this interest, or something that happened later on?
You know, I think as a kid, I was always just fascinated with ghost stories and science fiction and all that stuff. So I don't actually remember having any specific paranormal experiences when I was a kid. As I got a little bit older, as I was in high school and then in college, I had a few things happen. I had a strange experience with a Ouija board. And actually, probably one of the most interesting things from my perspective that happened was when I was in college. And I was going through... It was probably midterms or finals, and it was a pretty stressful time. And I woke up in the middle of the night a number of times, and I felt like I'd been pinned to the bed, and I couldn't move. And I sort of became fascinated with this idea of sleep paralysis. And I started learning about how many people experience sleep paralysis and the old hag syndrome, and I actually started collecting stories about different people's experiences and their religious backgrounds, and trying to see if there was correlation between what they were experiencing when they were going through the sleep paralysis and what their backgrounds were. I think that was kind of one of the first things that really sort of started me thinking about paranormal phenomena and or reported paranormal phenomena and alternative explanations for paranormal phenomena, and really started me thinking about how to start addressing these things in a systematic manner.
Yeah. When you know, sleep paralysis is not something I'm familiar with. Is that occur, you know, in a waking state, or is that, you know, when you're, is that a lucid dreaming when you can't move? What is sleep paralysis?
Well, it's a very common sleep disorder, and at least just about everyone experiences it at some point in their life. And sort of the non-technical, non-medical explanation is that, you know, as you fall asleep, your brain disconnects from your body, so you don't flail around in your sleep and try to act out your dreams. But then as you start to wake up again, those connections start to be reformed. And in some people and in some cases, those connections between your mind and your body take a little while to kind of come back together.
Right.
So you start to wake up, but as you start to gain consciousness, you don't actually have any control of your body, and that can kind of be a very frightening experience for a lot of people. So a lot of people get so their brains are sort of scrambling in this half-awake state for meaning, and so they start to imagine things like they're being held down, or they can't breathe, or they see things in the room, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, coffee helps for that, I find.
Yes,
when
it does.
When we talk about, the media, there are so many of these shows going on now, and it's nothing new. I mean, the paranormal always made for good programming on TV, but recently it's, you know, you can't turn on a TV without coming upon, you know, another ghost hunting show, you know. Now, I read you don't particularly like the term ghost hunting, do you?
No, I don't. I find it adversarial. I find myself using it because it's sort of what, you know, it's what everybody knows. So when I say ghost hunting, people understand what that means because, like you said, it's so prevalent in the media. When I say, I examine cases of alleged haunt phenomena, people are like, what the heck is that?
Right.
So I fall into the ghost hunting term. But, yeah, I mean, if ghosts are people, I find it sort of adversarial and mean to think about going out and hunting them down, and in some cases even eradicating them or getting rid of them.
Right.
So, yeah,
you know, they're not prey. We're just connected to them, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, when we look at these shows, I'm sort of grouping them together because to me they all look the same. I mean, do you think that they're fair representations of what actually goes on when you do a field investigation?
There's certainly, it's a chicken and egg sort of thing. I can tell you that what goes on television is very different than what I do in a scientific, systematic field investigation of an alleged haunted location. However, when most of these paranormal groups go out now, they pretty much follow the protocols that have been established by these television shows.
Right.
So, they've sort of set up the framework for what a standard paranormal investigation is. But, again, that's very different from when I go into the field and try to do things.
Yeah, well, you know, what strikes me is when you look at the shows and you see that they take, you know, some equipment, you know, like these trimeters and so forth, and you know, they would lead you to believe that These are specialized ghost hunting equipment that was developed for the ghost hunting industry, you know, but in fact, these are really devices that are used for other things and not necessarily to detect ghosts.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I've been doing this now. I think I did my first investigation in 1999, and I went to my first little haunted cemetery in Northern California with a group of friends that I dragged out in the middle of the summer. It was 100 degrees outside. But, you know, back then, way back then, in the dark ages of paranormal investigation, yeah, you used a lot of equipment that was technically off the shelf. And I actually do like that approach because it's equipment that's been around for a while. It's been tested. It's readily available for people to use. People generally know the tolerances of this equipment. However, over the last several years, a number of companies have sort of sprung up to make equipment that is now specifically designed for paranormal investigation. For example, there's a new meter now that, or relatively new meter, that combines both a real-time ambient air temperature display and a near real-time EMF display. So you can see what's going on in the environment on both of those reading scales. From both of those measurements very quickly on a single device. So now how useful these devices are in actually detecting ghosts is different than their usefulness in understanding what's going on in the environment.
Right. So when you go into when you decide to do an investigation of a particular site, is the first step to investigate the environment and try to discover some sort of environmental or physical cause that might cause what the people are reporting?
That is one of the steps in the process, but for me, that's like the 15th or 20th step in the protocol.
Uh-huh.
When I get a call from someone that's interested in having us do an investigation, the main focus of the first part of the investigation is understanding who these people are and what kinds of experiences they're having. So it's really very experiencer-focused. So that's a lot of our time up front. And in a lot of cases that I've worked on, depending on the kinds of phenomena that's being reported and the kind of information we're getting from them, I can solve a lot of cases without ever having to go on site.
Mm. You know, when you do, talking about that, I mean, when you solve a case, whether it's before you go on site or on site, what's the reaction of the people? Do you find that the people are relieved, or do you also find people that are somewhat disappointed because they were hoping that you would find something, you know, that would be, you know, what they would think to be otherworldly or paranormal?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It sort of runs the range. When I first started doing this, if someone said to me, you know, every call that came in, that someone said, I think I've got a ghost, like I would try to make an effort to get out there and at least talk to these people as quickly as possible. These days, I'm a lot more conservative about the kinds of cases that I take on.
Right.
So initially, when I would go on a case and I would find a non-paranormal cause for the reported phenomena, sometimes people would be genuinely relieved about, you know, not having a ghost in their house. But in some cases, some people do get very upset. They feel a need to have that connection for whatever reason. And
right.
Oftentimes people wouldn't believe me when I would show them our information, our data that we'd collected. And they'd throw us out of the house and they'd be pretty upset with us. So
yeah.
These days my cases focus primarily on people that want to understand the phenomena and are not anxious to get the phenomena exterminated or removed from their home.
Yeah. When is a ghost the same in your mind as an apparition, or are they two distinct things?
Well, I think an apparition can be any sort of stimulus or interaction. So, you know, there's visual apparitions and audible apparitions. The question is, you know, what is the cause of that apparition? So, for example, there's a whole body of literature about apparitions of the living or crisis apparitions.
Right.
So, for example, if I'm sitting here and, hopefully this never happens, but a loved one of mine is in a car accident and is injured, I might actually see them in my location, which may give me a warning that, that something has happened to them when they're far away. So that might be a crisis apparition.
Yeah.
So when I talk about a ghost, I'm really talking about the disembodied spirit of someone that was alive.
Yeah. So, well, aren't there, there were a lot of cases in, like, in a situation where you described where somebody's at a totally different location and sees this apparition of their loved one, and then later learns that that loved one died, you know, at the same time that they saw him. So in that case, you know, is that an apparition or is that a ghost?
Well, I think ghosts can cause apparitions and living people can cause apparitions.
Okay, so it goes both ways, right? All right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then when we talk about poltergeists, I mean, the general consensus is that, it's caused by, you know, psychokinesis, usually from the emotional states of a member of the residence or of the place that's citing this activity. So, I mean, is that what you find? That PK is the cause of what we term poltergeist?
Well, there's definitely this idea of poltergeist, and there's a lot of literature on this, and a lot of people have written about this and talked about it. But yeah, the general idea is that there's a living agent in the location, and the phenomena is being produced by some sort of PK of the living agent. However, in a non-poltergeist case where there's let's say there's a discarnate and a ghost that's walking around. If physical phenomena is actually taking place, that too has to be a function of some sort of PK because the ghost doesn't have a hand that it can go and smack things around.
Mm.
Right.
So
PK plays a role, but the question is it PK of the living? Is it PK of a discarnate? Is there a link between the desire of the discarnate and its ability to use latent PK ability in the living? So
right.
There's all this stuff that needs to get teased apart. And it's one of those things that makes investigating this stuff really interesting and really, really hard. And then when you take that and factor in this idea of what they call place memory, so this idea that some event took place at a location and an imprint of that event has been placed in the environment somehow, and when people enter into the event, into that location, they relive or experience parts of that event. So, you know, we've got these three possible parapsychological, paranormal causes that could be causing the phenomena. So as an investigator, one of the things I'm really interested in is trying to tease those things apart and figure out, you know, what's what and why some locations might be conducive to having a ghost where others might be more prone to place memory and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess what a research tool would be to determine whether there's any interaction going on, because that would sort of rule out, you know, a place memory if the ghost is reacting to your request, you know. So
that's possible, but there's this whole the whole other thing here is, you know, this idea of a retrocognition. Right. So
yeah.
If the information somehow exists in the environment, we could be cherry picking responses based on information that happened in the past.
Right. And I guess, you know, you know, it's one of the arguments people use about, you know, mediumship, you know, that it's not necessarily evidential of survival, but that, you know, the medium is able to retrieve this stored information based upon things that happened in the past. So the research is not an easy task.
No, actually it's not. And when you start doing this stuff in the field, it becomes even more difficult. And then when you start factoring in the emotional element or the personal element of the experiencers, it becomes even more and more difficult. So that's
yeah.
That's why I say when you know, the stuff that you see on TV is kind of fun, but when it comes to real systematic investigations, there's a lot of work. You know, these groups allegedly will go in and wave some meters around and within a day be able to determine whether or not a site is haunted or not haunted. When I do an investigation, it takes weeks just to get through the preliminary data collection. And for a lot of those groups, when they find an anomaly like a weird photograph or an EVP or a strange environmental reading, that's the end of their investigation. For me, that's actually when my investigation starts. When I've actually been able to document some sort of anomalous event, that's when we really dig in and start doing the science. The rest of the stuff is, you know, is just trying to figure out if anything's really going on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And we are talking with Mark Bacuzzi, and the number here is 1-888-815-9756. Mark, well, you know, many people, as I'm sure you've come across over the years, people who have lost, you know, friends and relatives and loved ones, they say they desperately want to be able to hear from them or see them, you know, and yet when people are, I'd say lucky, but when people are do happen to see their loved one, whether it be in a dream or in a waking state, and they see some sort of an apparition or a ghost, they're very fearful lots of times. You know, they can't handle it, you know, and it just seems to be, you know, you wonder why. Here you desperately want the contact, and when the contact comes, you know, you sort of step back. Do you think that has something to do with the media and what we were taught?
I think it does, yeah. You know, again, I'm not an expert in Aboriginal cultures or, you know, more traditional cultures, but my understanding is that when people had these sort of experiences, that they really embrace them. But nowadays, we're taught to fear all this stuff. I had an experience that was similar to that. Shortly after my father passed away, I had a very vivid dream that he was standing at the end of my bed, and he didn't say anything to me, but I just got the impression that everything was okay. And that was sort of the last time I had any real contact with him. And I personally found that to be a very comforting experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of people claim that that's frightening for them.
Mm.
And again, I think you're right. I think some of that has to do with what we see in the media, and then just people's personal belief systems as well.
Mm. When we talk about, you know, ghosts, you know, a disembodied a person that was in the body and now no longer is, the ghost making an appearance. I mean, do you theorize that it has more to do with the discarnate that's making it happen, or the receiver that's making it happen, or is it a combination of the two? You know, are there other things that come into play? You know, a lot of people think that you know, it's just totally up to the discarnate, and it may or may not be true. And any thoughts on that?
Well, that's an interesting question. The my sense is that all this stuff is probably a bit more complicated than we really think is going on, than the way we think of it. So my guess is that there's probably some kind of interesting intricate interaction between the discarnate, the environment, and the experiencer that kind of makes all this stuff happen.
Mm. What about, I know that Winbridge has done some work research with electronic voice phenomena. Is that a do you see that as being a promising tool, you know, in providing, you know, evidence of survival?
Well, I think it's an area that I actually love. I love EVP. I've been recording EVP for a long time, both in laboratory settings and controlled settings and in the field, and also expanding this idea of EVP into instrumental trance communication, ITC, using other kinds of technologies. I think it is a really important area that doesn't get enough attention from even quote-unquote mainstream parapsychology. There are parapsychologists that are interested in this field, but it's pretty fringe even within, you know, survival researchers. The problem, I think one of the big things with EVP is that all this stuff needs to be done under highly controlled conditions. So, for example, you know, you're familiar with Julie's mediumship protocol that she uses to test and verify information for mediums. And, you know, We've got five levels of blinding, and we've got three experimenters and two sitters and a medium and two, you know, possible discarnates. And the protocol is incredibly rigorous and really time consuming. I think one of the problems with a lot of the EVP research, is that, while there's some promising things that are coming out of it, there needs to be more active controls. There needs to be more work in this area so that people are developing new methods that factor out things like environmental problems or what they call false positives or pareidolia, the misinterpretation of of random information as meaningful information. But I think it's a really interesting and deep field, but there just needs to be a lot of work done to bring it up to speed. Right. And, you know, the same thing is true with ghost and haunting research. You know, a lot of people go in and they do these quick investigations, but in order to make it meaningful, you need to be using your equipment properly, and you have to have the right protocol and the right analysis and the right levels of blinding and the right set of controls. Right. So, you know, the level of rigor that's applied to mediumship research should really be applied to all these other areas of survival research as well. And in some cases it is, but I think in some of these more fringe areas like, you know, haunting and ghost investigation and even some areas of EVP or ITC, I think there's room for growth in those areas, which is really exciting.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about this. We're going to go to a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue that conversation with Mark Bacuzzi. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Did you know that there is an abundance of scientific evidence from well-credentialed scientists suggesting an afterlife? You now have an opportunity to learn about this evidence firsthand at Forever Family Foundation's conference in Fort Myers, Florida, November 13th and 14th. If you have suffered the loss of a loved one, or are simply curious about what happens after we die, don't miss this chance to see scientists and certified mediums share their knowledge and insights in lectures, workshops, and demonstrations, including small group medium readings. Call 631-425-7707 or visit foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.winbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.winbridge.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, EAAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Heal your loss and grief through these spiritual hypnotherapy CDs. Titles include Talking with the Dead, The Inner Healer, Meeting Your Higher Self, and A Past Life Regression and Between Life Exploration. Dr. Holly Holmes Meredith is director of HCH Institute for Hypnotherapy and Psychospiritual Trainings. Go to hypnotherapytraining.com to sample and order her CDs. These CDs will empower you in your healing and transformation.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Tuning in, our guest tonight is Mark Bocuzzi. This show is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research and Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. With these hard economic times upon us, some of our supporters write to say they love the radio show, they want to see it continue, they love the work of Forever Family Foundation, but they just don't have extra dollars these days to send our way. Even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do, and yet we want to do so much more. So this is how everyone can help without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out. And each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. But you don't have to stop there. If your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com. But first, use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website. And again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find your items in one of their 800-plus online stores, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. We also have our Holidays Past raffle that is going to be drawn in November. For just a $5 chance, you can win one of the 5 medium readings that we're raffling off with Bobby Allison, Angelina Diana, Rebecca Ann Lowe Cicero, Laura Lynn Jackson, or Kathy Towell. They're all certified mediums with the Forever Family Foundation. Also in December, we have coming up three different Holidays Past events. In December 4th with Angelina Diana and Afterlife Advocate Dave Kane in Bethel, Connecticut from 7 to 10. And going over to New Jersey, at Iselin, New Jersey, at the Hilton Woodbridge, we have Janet Nohavik on December 11th and December 18th. Angelina Diana is back, but she's in Melville, New York at the Melville Marriott. And we hope that you can join us for one or all of those. Go to the website at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Go to our events page, and you'll find the buy buttons for that. And with our upcoming November conference, time is running out. If you haven't reserved your seats, reserve them now. There are business opportunities if you need to advertise or sell some sort of your wares at our conference. So call us at the office at 631-425-7707. Bob?
And thank you for that. And Mark, I hope you're still with us through those announcements.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And number here is 1-888-815-9756. Fran touched on the conference that we're going to be having in Fort Myers, November 13th through 14th. And we are lucky that we have two members of the Winbridge team, Dr. Bichel, and our guest tonight, Mark Bocuzzi, that will be presenting at the conference. And it'll be fascinating when we talk about mediums, Mediums will be there that are also certified by Winbridge and went through their rigorous program. And there'll be some interactive experiments that are going on. So, as Fran mentioned, if you haven't checked it out, go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and make your reservation. Mark, when we left, we were touching on EVP a little bit. You know, I often thought about, you know, when if I turn on the recorder and I'm trying to pick up, voices from discarnate entities, in effect, I'm acting as a medium, aren't I? I mean, you know, I'm really involved in that process.
Absolutely. There's actually a book called The Mediumship of the Tape Recorder. So, yeah, you are. You're actively taking a role in that. And I think that's one of the things for me that's sort of exciting about EVP and ITC is that you don't need necessarily the an intermediary to make that connection. Obviously, you'll need the technology, and the technology would need to be worked out, and you need to understand the technology. But it's kind of a way for people to make that connection directly. On the flip side, the nice thing about using a medium is that they can kind of work with you through that process. So I think both of these techniques, whether you're working through a medium or whether you're working through some kind of technology, are valuable. It really depends on the individual and what their preferences are.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is that a lot of people, I'd say the vast majority, tape record their sessions with mediums, and we've had quite a number of reports from people that tape recorded this session with the medium and then later played it back, and although they never heard the voices during the reading, they have captured EVP. So, I guess it makes sense. I mean, if a spirit entity is taking part in the process, that you would capture, you'd have a greater chance of capturing voice.
Yeah, from an anecdotal perspective, that's really interesting and really cool. Obviously, we can't say that it's EVP. What we can say is that it's an anomalous sound because the recording wasn't done under controlled conditions. So, for example, when I'm at a haunt location and I'm doing an EVP recording session, I have multiple video cameras set up so I can see what everyone's doing. There are several people involved in the process. Everyone has a timesheet and a clipboard, and people are specifically designated to write down background sounds, and everyone has a stopwatch, so everything is time-coded, so we know when these background sounds occur. Then after the session is over, we take all those logs of those sounds and we put them into Excel and we sort them in time code order. So now we have a very detailed log of what happened during the session. And then we go back and we look at the recordings and we listen to the recordings and we correlate any sounds, any anomalous sounds with what we see on the log. And if there's something there that we can, make a one-to-one correlation with, we remove those sounds from the analysis. And then what's left is, pure background EVP potential sounds. So there really needs to be a rigorous process to actively identify and rule out conventional sounds during an EVP recording session before you can say that you've even started to think about that you've recorded an actual EVP.
Yeah. I know people, especially with the advent of digital cameras and people are taking way, more pictures than they used to, just from the ease and the cost factor, that a great many more orbs are being reported. Now, orbs, like any other phenomena, they could be a part of physical conditions, dust particles and so forth, and then again, it's possible that it could be energy of some sort. But I know that I read from a report, out of Winbridge, is that even if let's assume that an orb was a dust particle, that doesn't mean that the discarnate couldn't move the dust particle upon a request. So didn't you do some sort of a study like that?
We did, and I'm really excited about this study. We presented this as a poster at the ICEM conference earlier this year, and the basic idea is just that. There's a lot of evidence to show that when people get orbs in photographs, and I'm talking specifically about these photographic anomalies, you know, with these density spots, those things are really easy to recreate. They're generally dust particles or other or airborne particulates or light reflections that have been highlighted in the flash or the camera. And so it's my position that when you get an orb on a photograph, that's not a photograph of a discarnate or energy. It's a natural phenomena. But the real question, the real interesting bit is, a lot of people feel that they were somehow inspired to take the photograph at that time, and they feel a connection that the anomaly showed up at a time that was meaningful for them. So it begs the question, is there some other kind of discarnate influence that's going on, or some other kind of influence that's going on that inspires these people to take these photographs at these times, which then result in the presence of an anomaly in the picture? So we started to test that idea a little bit. So we set up, it's a very simple experiment, and I like to do simple experiments because I want other people to try to replicate them, but we basically got a laser, and we set it up in an open environment, in a home environment. So it was open air where dust and everything is moving around as it naturally would occur. And we had control sessions and we had active sessions. And we asked a discarnate to come in and move dust into the beam of the laser during active sessions, and to ignore the dust and not move things around during the control sessions. And during both active and control sessions, we photographed the laser using a tripod mounted remote triggered camera using a long exposure. And then we took all those exposures and we ran them through some software, and we did particle analysis, so we knew so when the dust entered the beam, the dust highlights and it shows up very nicely on these photographs. So we were able to really quantify the amount of dust in the beam at any given time. And then we ran the statistics on that, and what we found was there was a statistically significant result between the active and the control sessions, but it was in the reverse direction. So during the active sessions, there was actually less dust than in the control sessions. So that indicates that, well, one, we got to run it again, and we got to see if that's a consistent result. Or two, maybe the laser target was just too small for the discarnates to get move dust into that very small area or beam. But it's a really interesting protocol, and I think that it's something, the result was interesting. And again, it's this kind of thing we're continuing to work on that, and we're actually expanding it into some other areas as well.
Yeah.
So there could be a PK component where the discarnate's actually somehow moving the dust to the proper location, and then there could be a telepathic component that's giving people an inspiration, inspiring people through some sort of anomalous cognition to take the photograph at the location where the discarnate has moved the dust into the area. So,
yeah.
I mean, those are the kinds of things we're playing with, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be. You have a cool job.
I do have a cool job.
we talked a little bit before at the beginning about psychokinesis, and a lot of people just naturally assume that psychokinesis is from the living, but as you pointed out, that is probably not true. A lot of these phenomena that go on, that these seances and the physical mediumship the explanation that I've seen by many is that it's, caused by, PK from the living. But it certainly doesn't rule out, PK from the dead. Just because you don't have a body doesn't mean that you can't accomplish, a manipulation of energy through psychokinesis. You agree with that, I assume?
I think it's an interesting premise that I think needs to be tested more. But yeah, I can't talk too much about physical mediumship specifically. It's something I haven't studied, and I don't know all that much about it. It's a really interesting area that I'd love to do more with. But yeah, I think at this point the connection between psychokinesis and the requirement for a body to perform psychokinesis, that link hasn't been established. And I think that's an interesting area to research in detail.
Yeah, another fascinating area, and I know that you've been involved in it, you know, over the years, is there have been many studies and experiments with distant healing and intention and prayer and how, you know, intention can affect cells and plants. And I mean, to date, I mean, do you find the evidence compelling? And I mean, if you do, do you think that this may play a large role in medicine in the future?
I definitely think that things like energy healing and intention are going to play a huge role in medicine and how we think about treatment and things like that. Have you guys heard the story? I know we don't have a lot of time, but have you heard the story about how Julie and I met in a Faraday box where we were affecting each other's biology at a distance?
Actually, I did hear that story, but I don't know that you can tell it in the 3 minutes that we have. So I'm going to
tease
everybody.
It's probably a big deal.
They want to hear that story. They
got
to
come to the conference.
yeah, come to the conference. I'll totally will. I have a PowerPoint slide. It's, you know,
because then
awesome.
We can hear Julie's side of the story too.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually have photographs of that event when that took place way back when, in 2005. But yeah.
Cool. I wanted to remind people, you can find out more about Winbridge, the work that they're involved with, the players that are involved, by going to the website, winbridge.org, and you'll see a whole bunch of information. There are blogs, there are resources, there are links to their certified medium research.
And Winbridge has a Facebook page.
Winbridge has a Facebook page, Julie started the blog recently, right? And that's pretty interesting. So people can reach the blog by going on winbridge.org. That's correct.
You can go to winbridge.org, and then there's a news and events page, and you can click through to that, and that's got all of our current stuff. And there's also a link on there that says connect with us. And if you click on that link, it brings you to a whole page, which brings you to our blogs and lets you sign up to our email list and shows you where our Facebook page is. And it's all that. It's all the stuff on how to connect with us and keep up to date on all the things that we're doing here.
Yeah, and I'd like to remind our listeners, and I know that Mark and Julie get inundated constantly by people saying, well, why don't you research this, and why don't you do this, and why don't you do that? But the reality is that it's not, unfortunately, mainstream science today. There's not a lot of traditional funding methods, and you can take a part in that by joining, Winbridge, and they'll keep you up to date on their research, and you can help make things happen. I encourage our listeners to do that. Well, Mark, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's flown by, but we look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks and learning a lot more about all this these phenomena. And thanks so much for being with us. Join us again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always great.
See you in November.
See you in November.
See you in November.
Okay. All right. Take care, Mark.
All right. Bye-bye, you guys.
Bye-bye. And
with that, I'd just like to say my little prayer for the Gulf. Now let's give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico Gulf by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, corals, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. And that was by Matsuro Emoto back on May 9th, right after we had the oil spill in the Gulf. And
with that, what are you going to tell me?
Our loved ones are just a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it. Good night, everyone.